Good morning. I've never attended a parking seminar session where this standing room only and people are begging to hear what we have to say, so this is this is really scary. For someone who's been in the industry a little bit over 18 years, I definitely share, you know, Patrick's comments are just music to my ears, especially when we're dealing with clients and we're representing clients and getting in front of elected bodies and officials to just try to deal with the issue of parking and zoning codes that are either outdated or do not even relate to the area that we're looking at. I think the issue of parking is an issue of political will. I'll start with that. And if you are involved in dealing with government entities at all, you will realize that it's probably the uphill battle. I've been, you know, around parking, where parking has been the one topic for election and re-election of elected candidates, which is pretty sad given the state of our social fabric here. But it's a true matter. I mean, it is one that we deal with on a daily basis. We see it on a daily basis. Having spent 11 years in the government sector managing parking, some of the programs that Patrick is talking about, these are things that have been discussed for years, yet the lack of understanding or the lack to move forward with the fact that that we recognize we're a society that we're deeply in love with our cars. And we're all sitting here, and unlike Patrick, if I tell my wife that I'm going to get her a keychain that she's going to just call and, you know, she's going to share a car, she'll probably kill me. Because we're just in love with the automobile. I mean, we just want to drive it, we want to see a car. And not only are we in love with a car, we're in love with our parking spaces. You all know where you park every day. Some of us get to the office at a certain time every day, and we typically find our pretty close to our space. And when someone takes our space, which is not really ours, what do? We get upset. Highly upset. And if someone from our office, we'll try to send them like a little quick note, why are you taking my space? It happens every day. It happens every day. It happens in our building. And it's just amazing how we even go to lunch and we expect that when we come back, our space is there. And if it's not, we get really disappointed. The issue is, we have even failed to understand that the parking space, as an amenity, it doesn't really belong to us individually. It belongs to all of us as a whole. We struggle daily, when we're talking to municipalities, we're talking to developers about the concept of sharing the parking component. We deal with developers who just said we want to have two spaces per unit, and I'm going to refer to South Florida for a second, that I'll share some numbers with you. 13% of the population uses mass transit. In Philadelphia, 70% of the population uses mass transit. 13% walks to work. So look at these numbers. So all these developers want to build parking for their units because it's the marketability of the unit that's really attractive. Forget the fact that you have a granite countertop or a expansive kitchen. We're talking about parking. This is what really drives the market. And talking to, hearing Patrick talk about you buying the unit and you have to, by no choice, buy the parking space. But what we're finding is we're even in trying to share with these developers that they're building parking spaces at $28,000 to $30,000 per space. These spaces cost at a minimum $500 to $600 per space per year to maintain. And that's just maintaining these spaces at a reasonable level. I mean, we're not talking about having to replace expansion joints, elevators, topping, membranes, none of those things. Just typical maintenance, turning on the lights, watering, hosing it down, et cetera, staffing, security, and some of those issues. And every time we share with a developer, hey, South Florida has a drive-out ratio, or we refer to a drive-out ratio, and you can also look at it as a vacancy factor, of 60%, which means we get home at 5 or 6, we park our cars, and next morning at 6, 7 a.m., we drive out. And these spaces sit empty for the entire day, 8-10 hours a day, with no one else utilizing. We go down to downtown cores where, the perception is we have no parking. We do study after study after study, and everyone is in shock when we come back to the body, to elect the body, and say, you now have a parking problem, you have a perception problem. And the perception problem is that if 85% of your occupied spaces, of your spaces are occupied, we immediately perceive that there is no parking. And Patrick's comment about rooftops being empty consistently. It's consistently throughout the nation, and we do, you know, we see this, you know, up and down the East Coast. We see it on the West Coast. We see anywhere we go to, these spaces are empty, remain empty, and we do nothing about it. We continue to want to build a parking garage next door because, you know, we don't want to park, you know, exposed to the elements. Furthermore, we talk about, you know, the on-street parking that, you know, that's been referred to here is, you know, we have encouraged municipalities to manage those spaces by, you know, having loading zones and cargo zones and passenger loading zones being back, introduced back into the inventory, the parking inventory during night times on weekends. Specifically working with hotels that have very unique, you know, models of occupancy or peak demands, because also have cars that drive in and drive out at certain times where the parking spaces sit empty and no one uses it. When we've introduced programs that we've asked, you know, churches and places of religious gathering, and we've asked hotels, and we've asked some restaurants to share their parking inventory with the district, and most of these districts are linear in shape, everybody gets highly offended because what are we going to do if I have a client that comes to my, you know, to the restaurant or to the church? Well, the church is not in session. I mean, not all of us are going to go pray together at noon. It's just not going to happen. And we share this information with these folks, and we're having an uphill battle just trying to take the one, you know, commodity that we, you know, we continue to think that we have to build more of and not share it. And it is difficult. And the difficulty comes down to how we see it, strictly on the fact that there's a lack of political will to really move this process forward. And we're thinking that, you know, Patrick makes a great comment, we're preparing ourselves for the 100-year parking deficit. And I'm not sure that it's coming. But one of the challenges that we have as a group in our different communities is, you know, integrating our transportation systems into these, you know, to this parking inventory. You know, there's a number of very successful pay in lieu of parking programs where the revitalization of very small, unique, historic, you know, districts with restaurants and art shops are coming back alive when the, you know, when the zoning requirements completely waived so they can be in business, and then you can utilize offsite parking and have people walk into the district and people be bused into the district. And there's a great deal of success of those stories. Yet these are towns and communities that have made a true commitment to, you know, to reducing the parking inventory, not because they just want to get rid of it, but because they realize that otherwise, you know, the storefronts will be continue to be shut down because there's physically impossible at times to provide a physical parking space. So we recently came back from a project in Key West, which granted its first parking variance in its history of over 100 spaces. And this is a hotel, conference center, restaurant, shopping, et cetera, 27 acres. It's probably the most significant project Key West has seen in the last 20 to 30 years. And it was not difficult at all, which is really insane in our case, to discuss the opportunities that this hotel, resort, conference center was going to be able to utilize its parking demand from its rooms to its restaurant and to its conference center. And believe it or not, you know, the elected body just, you know, saw the vision that there was an opportunity to reduce the number of parking spaces that had to be built from like 989 to about 880 or so spaces. And it was well received. Obviously, the process is cumbersome. That process involves, you know, parking is a very dynamic process. What happens in Philadelphia does not typically happen in South Florida, and definitely not in San Francisco or some of the West Coast and Midwest states, et cetera. It's very unique to its nature, yet it's apparent how it behaves. It's pretty similar in a lot of our places. So I'll open it back to the board.
So what we're going to do now is I've prepared some questions, and we're going to have some time for you to ask questions, but we'll sort of, this is part two where I get to ask the questions. And then make sure that that's just my prerogative. It has to do with, I'm sure many of you have encountered this, municipalities that are experimenting with the opposite of minimum parking requirements, of the idea of maximum parking requirements. I've been involved with a couple cases where jurisdiction has said, you know, we only want you to have this many spaces, period, that's it. And the developers said, well, you know, frankly, I don't want to build more than I have to, honestly, but you're killing me here because I can't, in this case, sell a condominium without these spaces. And unfortunately, everybody else out there selling condominiums
Yeah. I think Neil has pointed out the problems with this technique. It can be a very blunt instrument. If you think about offices, for example, some offices that are going to be call centers, they pack, you know, little tiny people into cubicles. And so that can have easily 10 employees or 12 or 15 employees per 1,000 square feet and a parking demand of 10 spaces per 1,000 square feet occupied. And then you have something like my company where we probably have a parking demand of we hired a guy, we did a diversity hire, and we hired one guy who drives to work alone. You know, 50 employees and one driver and about 10,000 square feet, I know. So, with that kind of range, if you simply say the maximum is 3 spaces per 1,000 for office and have no other alternative, that can be very tight. My favorite technique is downtown Portland, for example. What they did is they set an overall cap for the district for a long time for downtown. And then they said, okay, each parcel has the right to build a certain number of parking spaces. And then, and essentially they set their cap at a level that was designed to prevent gridlock on the streets outside. The number of spaces allowed was limited by the capacity of the streets leading to those parking garages. And then they allow you to sell your right to build parking on your parcel to somebody else. One thing is that since commuters at the peak hour, the worst part of traffic congestion, often setting maximums for offices but not so much for residences can be the way to go. But having a tradable system of parking rights, in downtown Portland, one historic building with no parking sold all of its parking rights to the property next door that was a major new hotel. And so that system can work fairly well to get the benefits of maximum parking requirements without the big problems that can sometimes result.
I would say we've seen developers kind of getting away from segregating the parking spaces or the parking component for the residential during the daytime and putting those spaces back into the inventory from 8 a.m. to 3, 4, 5, 6 p.m. Therefore, the opportunities for a retailer to be in the same development, taking advantage of that opportunity. What we see is the issue here has been for developers and parking has been security and the marketability of the units. Marketability, obviously, because everybody wants a parking space, and security because people coming after work may feel unsafe because of the parking structure, and they would like to see some kind of segregation. And when they do the segregation of the parking component, typically on the upper levels, then what happens is those spaces will remain empty for the rest of the day. So understanding that there's some efficiencies if they do share those spaces, and perhaps they don't have to share it with the general public. They can share it with employees who are part of the mixed use complex or part of the urban fabric. That may be the solution.
I want to go to that idea of tradable parking rights and expand on that a little bit. And Rami, I'm going to direct this question to you.
I'm sorry. It doesn't work. That could be the problem.
I'll just speak loud. Rami! Can you imagine a strategy in which the church that you referred to that was hesitant to let's say, share its parking when it wasn't used, had a way to monetize that parking that wasn't used so they could actually get a revenue stream from it, and I'm using that as an example, but to actually value this underutilized parking that sits in private hands, that sits all over cities, many of which is in institutions like churches and others that don't use it all the time, that somehow they contribute that to a pool, get paid for that by the municipality, and in turn someone else who is short of parking can buy into that. They don't necessarily literally have access to those particular spaces, but they quantify. Do those kind of things exist? Do they work?
Absolutely. I go back to, you know, my experience was, you know, the parking authority in Miami was established as an autonomous agency, so it has very little political input, and it's probably the best way to manage the parking inventory, where you somewhat buffer the political will or lack. lack of political will as it relates to parking strategies, et cetera. But one of the things the parking authority established was the opportunity to work with places like, places of worship, buildings that have ample parking but yet are either empty or unoccupied. And what they did is they will enter into an interlocal agreement with those places and either upgrade or resurface their parking, or surface parking, restriping, add some landscaping. So put some capital improvements into these locales and turn for the opportunity to turn those spaces into the public domain. And that's worked very well, where these places have little or no money to put back into the infrastructure, and the parking authority just comes in and at $1,000 a space or so, redevelops, resurfaces, restripes, relights, and reintroduces these things. One of the places that is very common in South Florida is post offices have built for many years a number of parking spaces for their employees and for the storage of their vehicles. And they have become of interest to the parking authority as additional inventory. Therefore, employees, in very many occasions are parking in some of these districts, are parking in the post offices with a deal between the parking authority and the postal services, where the parking authority has, resurfaced and, maintained the lighting, cleaning, landscaping, et cetera, and that's worked very well. So there's absolutely an opportunity for that.
Great. I've got two more questions, then I'm going to open it up. The opposite end of the spectrum, minimum parking requirements. Minimum parking requirements. Patrick, you had mentioned that that's step one is or was up there. One of the steps was eliminate the minimum parking requirements. But I found that actually sometimes the developers or retailers in particular can be their own minimum parking. I mean, you can get rid of the minimum parking requirement, it doesn't matter. And I'm working on a project now of a great field infill in a suburb of Dallas, and we're trying to infill some shopping centers, let's say. And a new tenant is coming into a grocery store site, potentially, and they said, we were kind of approaching the subject of, moving, reducing the parking or filling some stuff in very gingerly. And they say, by the way, as far as parking goes, we don't really have enough parking here. We really need 6 spaces per 1,000 square feet of retail, which was a new one for me. And, my eyes just sort of bugged out of my head, and I didn't know what I was at a loss, And I guess I'm wondering, what should I have said at that point?
All right. Do you remember 10 years ago, maybe, when the Urban Land had a cover story and the shocked face of a man was on the cover and it said they dared to mix uses? Right? They now, of course, developers are saying, and retailers are like, mixed use, no problem, we do that all the time. The force of habit and convention of people who have been trained to do conventional suburban things will take years to overcome. But one of the things that we've done is to sit down and study actual thriving mixed-use places where very rich people spend huge amounts of money. So, for example, downtown Santa Monica, California, the actual parking demand is about 1.9 spaces occupied per 1,000 square feet of development, including all of the on-street parking spaces. And you go there, and it is obviously full of very high-demand uses, like 35 movie screens and retail shops. And so if you take somebody to a place like that and say, would you like to be doing business here? And they all say, yeah, well, sure. And you say, well, this is the actual reality of this place. And they go, but I can swear there's 6 per 1,000. So Palo Alto turns out to be Palo Alto, California, turns out to be about the same demand. Of course, real cities like Philly are much, much, much lower.
Great. And then one more. We use, our clients use the ULI shared parking standards for, the progressive ones. Use that because it is the thing that is respected. The ULI shared parking standards are the holy grail of parking, shared parking standards. I mean, everybody respects them. The one thing they don't do is that I can remember, is give you any share for residential, because they just assume that people want their space when they get home. If they come home early at 4 o'clock and somebody's in their space because they haven't left work yet, they're just just pissed off, as your wife would be. I would be. So I'm wondering, are there any other shared parking kind of guides out there, or are there better shared parking kind of quantifications out there that we should be using, or that take that into account?
We always refer everyone wants to either hear the ULI, you know, referred guidelines, but we are very regional, very local when it comes to those guidelines, and that is, you know, we always talk about, you know, the office, and Patrick mentioned, you know, what kind of office, what kind of use, what's the intent, and just basically do it on a very unique, you know, level and opportunity. The ULI, we use it as a guide and say, well, the ULI says. But what we found in this particular location is, for example, South Florida, there's a drive-out ratio or vacancy of 60 to 70 to 80% every day. And we know that because for the first time in South Florida, there are people living in downtown Miami. So we already established to see the trend that the ULI does not apply in downtown Miami. Absolutely does not apply. And if you utilize it, you're going to overbuild parking and you're going to have parking spaces sitting there empty for the rest of your life. It's just not going to happen. Now you go back to somewhere like Hoboken, which we completed a study, and the drive-out ratio is absolutely like 5% of the people who drive out. In fact, most of the parking component in Hoboken is now being utilized as storage for Manhattan, where people are paying $400 to $500 to store their car with a car, you know, a little cover over them, because that's what they do. And then during the weekend, they'll come into, you know, take the ferry line into the city, you know, get their car and go do whatever they got to do. So in that case, it doesn't even apply either. So it's very specialized. It is, you know, parking requirements and how they behave is very unique to its location. And you can use the ULI as a standard, but do not just completely blindly take it as is.
Okay, so we're going to open up to questions. And the gentleman in the white jacket in the wall there has the first one.
Getting back to your drive-out rates, you know, private off-street parking, do you figure feasibility of some sort of scheme along with HAPIC 7 steps of having all of those spaces metered and the meters going all the time so that when the space is empty, it's generating a deficit that gets charged to the property owner. When it's occupied, it's generating an income that is split between the benefit district and the property owner as an incentive toward shared parking or demand for reduced parking.
Homeowners associations right now in downtown Miami are encouraged to, you know, put back introduce their parking spaces into the public domain. And if they do so, they get compensated for it. So what they're doing is talking about reducing the homeowner's fee is, hey, I have a parking space, sits here empty most of the time, go ahead and use it. And it's introduced back into the public domain, and it's a benefit to the homeowner, because at the end of the day, they're paying real estate taxes not only on their units, but they're paying real estate taxes on the parking component as well, as a homeowners association.
Yeah, and gentleman right here.
Well, I'm curious about that whole concept of whether you get, we're from New York, and it's pretty litigious around it. So I'm just curious whether you get into liability issues when people say, go ahead, use my parking place, but if you trip and fall, I'm going to sue you.
Liability is, you know, it's covered under a monthly agreement with, you know, in this case, the government entity or the parking authority is the one managing those spaces. So as a result, it is, you know, you waive certain rights and you inherit certain rights. That's some reality to that.
Okay, gentlemen in the purple shirt.
I'm in a town of about 70,000 people. We have a main street that has on-street parking. It's frequently filled, but you go one block over and there's parking lots that routinely have, you know, a quarter filled. Yet I keep hearing from my constituents that we have a parking problem, but we don't. So how do you get that message out there from a city government side and let people know that you've got to go one block over and there's plenty of parking?
Well, I would say that you do have a parking shortage on your main street, and you don't have a parking shortage a block away.
Right.
And if you look, for example, at Redwood City, they had the problem of that exact same problem. And what they did is they said, okay, we're putting meters on Main Street. We're going to raise the rate until people actually walk a block. The question is not how far will people walk from parking to go to retail. The question is how far will they walk to save a dollar? You know? And if you're staying for 10 hours, $5 in parking is $1 an hour, then you're likely to walk further. And if you're staying for 5 minutes, you're going to be happy to pay for meters. So in Redwood City, one of the beauties is that because they are using prices to make vacancies on Main Street, they got rid of all their time limits. You never get a ticket for overstaying the meter. You never run out in the middle of a massage and stick another quarter in the meter. You simply park for as long as you want. So raising the price on Main Street until people use your underused lots will clear the problem.
I would say a typical problem is the pricing on the street is, sometimes we find cities where if you're an employee, you're encouraged, if you're smart enough to add, you're encouraged to park on the street all day because the parking on the street is, on the street is cheaper than the parking on the street. And we share that, and they look at you like if you're really crazy when you said something like this, because it's common sense. Pricing is the only way you're going to get people, to walk. The other thing is, your streetscape, your signage, programs and incentivizing employees to park in the outskirts. It's just the reality of it. City of Miami Beach has a parking garage on, and this is South Beach, the heart of South Beach, on 7th and Collins. This parking garage generates $55 to $5,700 per space at $1 an hour. Now, you imagine what this parking garage would generate if you just double that. That's probably one of the most profitable parking structures in the industry right now. Now, and I say that based on rates. The issue is very simple. The city is struggling with its traffic congestion, struggling with its traffic parking inventory. We finalized a study. We said your rates are—it's just insane. There's no way people can just be encouraged to park anywhere and drive, and either bus in. They have a very successful circulator or shuttle program. People are not encouraged to do that because they can park for $1 an hour. You're never going to get people out of the main core, and that's the issue. Pricing. It's absolutely the tool.
Yes, right.
Okay. You mentioned the more parking, the better. And I'm asking myself about how to increase capacity in the high demand areas by accommodating technology. For instance, using automated parking system, robotic systems that easily can double the capacity compared to any other arrangement.
By the way, I just want to be clear. I didn't say I believe the more parking, the better was a good thing. I just was saying that was an attitude that was out there, but I understand the questions about robotic parking.
Robotic parking does work. There's right now 3 installations in the U.S. There's one in Hoboken. There's one in D.C. for about 68 spaces. There's one in New York City, about the same number of spaces. Obviously, the events that happened in Hoboken kind of set back the industry of robotic automated parking. They had.
I can't tell what those are.
The issue was the parking. The manufacturer and the contractor got into a debate about the functionality. There was some discrepancies in the build out and how it was built, etc. It was not open for over 2 years. Bunch of litigation, bunch of lawsuits, lots of money, lots of revenues, and in the end, it kind of settled quietly, but. It set back the industry quite a bit. It does work. 2 things of concern that you have to look at. One is what is the use and what is the intent. If it's a residential component, it's a lot easier to manage and to control. If it's in your office component, retail component, then you run into difficulties of queuing, traffic congestions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
We're working with a robotic parking idea right now. It's a different planning strategy that you use for the parking because of how you want to make it, the efficiency of it. It's great because it's a much smaller footprint. But you do lay it out, you lay out the urbanism a little bit differently as a result.
Can you share with us quickly what robotic parking is?
Basically, it's like a machine that takes your car and moves it around. It's like a big chest of drawers. And elevators, and it moves them horizontally and vertically, and you get a little key thing, and you stick it in a slot, and it says, oh, you're number 27.5, and you
and the difficulty,
your car.
And the difficulty with our society is, remember, because we're in love with our cars, when we see our car go into an elevator and go away, we start wondering. I just want to give you that hint.
I've talked to about 4 people on our planning commission. I'm in Austin, Texas, and I've to have those conversations, and I can totally relate to the political will issue because, you know, very quickly, even though they themselves often would like some reductions in parking as well, they're just so short on time to listen to it because they just think that it's not politically viable. So I think, you know, and then I've talked to a 15-acre landowner in my neighborhood where I'm the president of the association, and they've said, no, I don't want to give up any parking. So we're dealing with the will of the landowners, the will of the political people. What would be helpful is for the suburban environment, if you could help us with maybe not as much an urban environment, but more of a suburban environment. What are some studies that we could either do that would be low cost and effective in terms of the will? How, you know, what are some things that we could do that you've seen that are effective?
In Ventura, California, 2% of the downtown workers ride transit to work. You know, it's pretty darn suburban. All the parking is free. And the way that we got a 6-1 council vote in favor of getting rid of all the free parking is we said, let's start this conversation by making a list of everything that downtown merchants wish they could fund and can't. You know, new street trees, new streetscape, new. We made this huge wishlist that would cost millions of dollars. And then we said, well, you know, we could fund all that if we charge for the parking. And you know, so the discussion was all about getting huge amounts of money, not about less parking. The discussion needs to be about more money, not less parking.
Patrick, I don't think that's this question. I mean, I want to push this question a little bit, because I know downtown Ventura, and it ain't this place. I don't know it, but I'm sure it isn't. Because that's a little town. It's a beautiful little city that may have had a suburban parking count, but had an urban, and the infrastructure was public. I think he's talking about, I'm guessing, a suburban set of shopping centers. Yeah. And, you know, you think 6 more trees is going to help that? Or, I mean, it's owned by an entity, and I think it's a different paradigm than Ventura.
Yeah, I mean, that looks like a clear redevelopment site. Right? And when you look at the dead shopping malls all over the country, one of the first things that happens is that new urbanists, they create these fantastic drawings of the park that you're going to have and everything else. And then everybody asks, well, where did the parking go? And they say, well, we stacked it up in parking structures. And then you try to figure out how to fund that. So that's when you can do things like pull out the studies of actual mixed-use parking areas. I'm sorry, actual mixed-use districts where very few people use transit. Those places, even though nobody's riding transit, just from the mix of uses, just from the sharing, we see that typically the overall demand is about 1.5 to 2.5 spaces per 1,000 square feet. Once you can show that to a typical developer, or even if you use the ULI shared parking manual, that's a great start. But once you can show that, and then show the savings on parking, as long as you can reassure people that it won't all spill over into their neighborhood, then they're okay. Sometimes the biggest hurdle is setting up residential parking permit districts or something like it to stop the spillover into a nearby neighborhood.
Okay, I guess there's floor there.
I'm a municipal planner in the Northeast, so we have snow removal issues. And one of the things that we've actually done, and I've convinced our commission to do, is we have minimum parking requirements, but what we've done is attach conditions of approval to any special permit or special exception. Anything over the minimum has to be pervious, which means they have to change their material from asphalt to gravel or grass pavers or something. It tends to be more expensive. We've had very good luck with keeping it to what the minimum is. So.
That's great. Yes, Bob.
I'm thinking in a city like Providence, where there's a perception of a shortage of public parking, and not a particular will of the municipality to produce parking. There's no municipal garage, for instance. And we're building housing, and I'm thinking, could we, like the Santa Monica model you have, where the meters actually come off of are not just on the street, but also in the lower levels of a new parking structure. So you actually have more on-street parking in the structure, and then the residential above that. Would that kind of thing work? Have you seen that happen anyplace? And does that allow the city to get in and finance, new on-street capacity that just happens to be in parking structures?
From our end, we find cities being able to finance parking structures just as a result of adding a use other than a parking component. And talking about new urbanism, adding a retail component at the ground level, adding some active space between on second and third levels, which are some of the requirements that we're seeing in zoning codes. You can't just no longer just do a parking structure. You're going to have to add a use that's going to add some activity at the pedestrian level, and that's and absolutely parking meters or time parking in a parking structure is also a viable way to increase your inventory. The only caution is if you fail to price right your inventory overall in any city, you're gonna have issues of perception that there is no parking because everyone, especially employees, take the most the best spaces and for no money, and then the residents once you go into a parking structure and you take three turns, you come in, you do one turn, you come in, you do then you take another turn, and you go after the third turn. And you do not find a parking space. Your perception is this parking garage is full, and you're going to find a way out. Although the rooftop is empty.
But Rami, I know if you park in any of those places that have the electronic stuff, that honestly does help.
It does.
27 spaces, two levels up.
It does. But some that's technology that's coming online, and people are finding useful. But a lot of times the perception is like Patrick said, the rooftops are empty, and people are coming in or not even going in at all. The other issue is the issue of perception. It's not perceived to be parking structure, not perceived to be safe. So they just just rather circle the block 82 times to find that their lucky spot, what I call a parking consultant spot.
Yes, over here, outside the door.
Yeah, sure. It's pretty common in many commercial districts. It, on the residential side, it's pretty much the norm in the Washington, D.C. area.
Okay. Another comment.
It's the end of the old paradigm.
Whoever needs to get the light, try, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another thing, you can certainly, if you go to Patrick Kennedy's developments in Berkeley, California, he unbundles the parking. One thing that you have to be careful about is if you don't have residential parking permits or parking benefit districts in place nearby, then you will be perceived as causing a problem, right? So sometimes the best thing to do is cause the problem and then help fix it, but yeah.
We found two other projects that the developer approached the parking authority and leased the parking, from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. and on weekends for the residential project. And right now, he built over 600 units without any parking.
Briefly, because not every city has a parking authority, and even the idea of a parking authority is sometimes controversial, do you want to just spend a minute or two explaining parking authorities?
Well, parking authorities could be parking, could also be parking departments, but the only benefit I think the parking authority will bring is the parking authority is a semi-autonomous agency that is governed by a board of directors that is typically appointed, self-appointed, and ratified by the elected bodies. New Jersey is probably the state with the largest number of parking authorities. Most of the Northeast or a lot of the Northeast states do have parking authorities. The other form of parking management is parking departments. Historically, when this whole thing started, when there was no one will talk about it, Public Works Department will manage parking authorities. Police departments have also managed parking inventory, etc. But I think the most essential way to do it is by either parking authority or parking district or an overlay district. Some bids in the business improvement district are managing parking inventory in downtowns, etc. So it's just a form of managing the inventory that kind of allows you to make decisions based on what's really happening and what to work.
And we have time for one more question, so it'll be this gentleman right here.
My question is more of a suburban setting where
Patrick, he can't answer this.
Where you have where we're going to create the problem. We have a it's a very suburban town. We're doing an infill project. small lot, and probably our parking will spill. And yet, to make it new urbanist and feel good, we need to keep it dense. But the surrounding neighborhood or the city may say you don't have enough parking, or the surrounding neighborhood. How do we? Do you have any suggestions?
When Patrick Kennedy did his residential infill projects in Berkeley, which thinks it's a suburb and never wants to grow up, he actually agreed to the condition that none of the tenants of his building would be permitted to get residential parking permits for the nearby neighborhood. In other cases, when I worked at Stanford University, we offered to pay all of the costs of setting up a residential parking permit district for an adjacent neighborhood, and then we threw in enough to pay for three parking spaces, which was a $120,000 cash payment to them. So helping them over that, or if it's a really progressive neighborhood, you say, can we let a few people spill over in your neighborhood and you collect money from them?
It's about 12:15, so I think that, and I'm sure that the panelists will be happy to answer your questions.
Good morning.